Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between our personal health and well-being and what's going on in our total environment, the health of our air, water, air, food, earth, all of that is really relevant to the health that we experience as individuals, the health of our communities, the health of our society, the health of the global ecology on planet Earth. We're widening the lens on personal health concern to societal concern, community concern, global concern, and ecological concern. And that's what we do every week on Connect the Dots with different thought experts, advocates, scientists, leaders, authors, and others who talk about all of the different ways and things that are going on in our world that health-oriented people need to be oriented to protect our health and the health of our families and future generations. I'm a long-standing journalist in these areas. We cover a lot of public policy issues going down the pike, and we figure out and identify ways that we can be active, involved, and contribute, and as proactive on a societal level as many health-oriented people like to be on a personal level. So that's what we do every week on this show. And as our regular listeners are aware, we've been covering quite extensively over the past 6 weeks or so, and as well as over the last year, trade agreements that are soon coming to Congress, and to our global economies that will have profound impacts on all the areas that we cover on this show. It's taken a lot for Americans to kind of get involved, engaged, aware, and activated on a range of different health, food, and environmental fronts and policies, and the societal decisions that are made, in our states, in our localities, and on a federal level. And as people get more and more involved and really recognize that a lot of our choices, our well-being, our options are determined by social policy decisions, we now have a new order of concern that we have to deal with. It's really been terrific over the 4+ years that I've been doing this show to see people stepping up in the special areas of interest to them. And all these areas are of interest to me and I cover regularly on this program. But now we have a new order of concern, which is global treaties that have been designed by multinational corporations over the last 5 years, and that if passed, is coming to Congress very soon and could occur within the next month or so, would have very long-range and far-reaching effects that in some cases would overrule many of the initiatives and things that we've been trying to accomplish. And that's why I've devoted so much time to these treaties and why it's so important to follow and understand the implications of them. And that's hard to do, of course, because they've been kept secret. There's an effort to vote them through a fast-track authority in Congress and keep them secret so that, in effect, they're passed without our ever knowing their full contents. Fortunately, thanks to the Internet and international organizations, and national organizations that are, connecting with each other across the globe, we do know a lot, and we're going to learn a lot more about how all of this is going to affect food in today's program. Our guest today, I'm so delighted to say, is Karen Hansen-Kuhn. She is the Director of International Strategies for a terrific organization called Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Karen has a very impressive background, and we're going to learn more of her wisdom on this show. She's been working on trade and economic justice issues since the beginning of the NAFTA debate. That is really important as we are poised, as our president is pushing, to pass several, trade bills, global trade bills, trade agreements, to really look at how these agreements have served us in the past. She's many published articles on trade and agricultural policies, the impacts of U.S. biofuel policies on food security. That is certainly of tremendous interest because we've covered a lot to do with our fossil fuel use on this program, as well as women and food crises. So she's just got an incredible, an amazing background in international work and knowledge of these agreements. And she can bring to light what is going on and what we need to be concerned about. Welcome.
Thank you.
The Dots, Karen. So great to have you here today.
It's nice to be here.
So, you know, just sort of parenthetically, it's possible, you know, we're hearing rumors that Fast Track, which would kind of pass the two trade deals that are on the table, the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, is the one that, you know, kind of has become the flagship name for all the agreements. But the one we'll be discussing more in today's show, which I think bears an in-depth discussion, is the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And that is the agreement with Europe. And we'll be discussing this in the context that Fast Track, which would kind of rubber stamp both agreements, you know, kind of create safe passage for them without their contents ever being revealed to the public, you know, maybe coming up to the floor of the Senate for a vote within a couple of weeks. So all of what we're talking about today does have action points to it and is rather urgently important. We've been reporting on this, on these treaties on the show for, you know, a few months and really the entire year, saying they're coming. And so one thing we want to say today and talking with you is they're soon here. So let's just, you know, get a little bit of the benefit of your longstanding wisdom, you know, covering these issues. And since the NAFTA debate, you know, a lot of people feel, oh, well, a treaty, what does that have to do with me? You know, and if the president is saying, oh, it's going to bring jobs, it's going to improve our economy, it's going to do this and that, you know, they're kind of like, well, that sounds like a good thing. You know, so, I mean, looking back at NAFTA, just briefly, because we're really going to focus more on the new treaty in Europe, but looking back on NAFTA, let's just make sure that, you know, we're kind of looking at the lessons learned about what these treaties have been promised to do and actually do.
Well, NAFTA, it's a good case study. You know, I focus on agriculture and food systems, so that's what I would be talking about. And if we look at what happened since NAFTA, we see some pretty dramatic changes both in the U.S. and Mexico because, you know, we had tariffs lifted on all kinds of things, new protections for foreign investment. We saw a lot of shifts in both where goods went and the investment rules. So we had this whole process where the U.S. started exporting a whole lot more corn to Mexico. Corn exports increased like four times. And many Mexican farmers, millions, were driven out of business. Then they fattened up the pork, the pigs, in Mexico, shipped them back to the United States so they could sell them cheap. Well, so along the way, for American farmers, we had them losing bargaining power in the supply chain, so it became harder for them to negotiate good prices. And then in Mexico, we had this kind of unexpected, I would say, shift in what they call the default food environment. Because of those changes, there was a lot more consumption of dairy, of meat, but also new investment in fast food restaurants, in junk food, processed foods, soda, supermarkets. These all increased pretty dramatically, and the obesity rate in Mexico shot up. So now the U.S. and Mexico are tied for the highest obesity rates in the world. And
awful.
Not just only because of the trade agreement, but it is, I think you really can trace, you know, these specific changes that led to changes in the food that was available to people.
Mm-hmm. And that, that is so fascinating. You know, and I actually, in an earlier incarnation, you know, working for proactive health approaches, in other words, let's not just do drugs and surgery, you know, to solve the problem. Let's get to the root of the problem. It's great that we have options when there are cases of advanced disease, but how do we, slow, stop, or intervene in the trajectories toward disease? And do things today that are easier, simpler interventions, like eating healthier, in order to prevent illness. This was really my focus for 20 years. I worked on a whole bunch of different health books and with leading experts and authors. I worked helped to develop the very first book by the leading clinician who researched the pediatric obesity epidemic, for example. And we know, you know, and so there have been an army, you know, we know what people need to eat and kind of not eat. And an army of doctors have been kind of, you know, urging people as to what to do. But, you know, I got into policy around this exact issue because if we don't have the right food options, if we don't, you know, encourage a healthy food supply, if in fact we build an unhealthy food supply, it places a burden individual by individual to make these choices, and sometimes it's not even economically feasible to do anything but eat, you know, unhealthy foods. And we kind of, you know, we think if we just exhort an individual that that's a substitute. And for exactly the reason you're describing, it is no substitute at all. And there'll be major health costs coming from all of this, and are, no doubt, that's already occurring.
Absolutely. And so you're right. The food that's available to Mexicans in this case, the environment of food has changed. And so their eating habits have changed, too. Now, the Mexican government is taking some actions to try and change that. But one action they took a few years ago was to raise tariffs on high fructose corn syrup.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was partly to protect Mexican sugar producers, but there were health concerns as well. And
definitely,
they got sued under NAFTA's investor-state dispute settlement mechanism.
Wow.
This is a provision in the treaty that lets companies sue governments over any kind of measure that affects their potential profits. And so in this case, there were three separate suits against the Mexican government. They lost all of them. They had to pay $169 million in compensation, and then subsequent to that, changed the law. So this is something, you know, another issue, one of the lessons from NAFTA that we're concerned about as we move forward.
That is terrible. That is an absolutely horrific thing. Here is the government. I mean, A, they're trying to protect, you know, their local crops, and, you know, sugar, excess sugar consumption is not indicated either. But, you know, studies reveal that there's like a kind of an ampage of the glycemic factor in high fructose corn syrup. It's highly prevalent in fast and processed foods. Food scientists use it, you know, to kind of lure people to eating these foods. And so here they are protecting a local crop that, you know, it's not fabulous, but it's natural. It's less benign in terms of its glycemic impact, as well as the health of their people. They're not allowed to do so. And in fact, they have to pay. They have to pay the companies. This is like, you know, this is backwards, completely backwards. Now, will the new agreements that we're talking about, will, for example, the Atlantic Agreement, let's call it the Atlantic Agreement, it's called the TTIP, which I mentioned at the opening of the show, but, you know, these acronyms can kind of be a little much for people, I sometimes feel. So it's really the agreement between ourselves and, you know, Europe, European partners and all. Will that put us at risk for similar provisions?
It really could. I mean, one thing on the name, a lot of us are saying we should be calling this the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, or TAFTA, because it really is a lot like NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
I would say this issue of this investor-state dispute settlement, these corporate courts, mm-hmm. has become a huge concern in Europe. They mm-hmm. had a petition, a European Citizens Initiative, 1.5 million people signed a petition calling for that to be excluded from the trade agreement. And part of the issue in Europe is that they're already facing some similar, really terrible lawsuits. In Germany, after the Fukushima disaster, they decided to phase out nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, a Swedish firm that was building nuclear power plants, or wanted to, is suing them for $5 billion.
Oh, my goodness.
There are many other suits. That one has been particularly famous. And so there's a huge concern in Europe, and a lot of people questioning you know, why would we would need this kind of provision? The rationale is that companies can't get a fair shake because sometimes legal systems aren't adequate. Well, the whole premise is kind of silly, but certainly between in Europe and the United States, it's hard, I think, to justify having those kinds of courts. The other thing we have to think about, though, is in terms of how it might affect the U.S., there are something, Public Citizen did a survey of all of the European companies investing in the U.S., and there were something like 20,000 companies.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, I think smaller countries have been reluctant to sue the United States, but I would say, you know, if it were with Europe, I wouldn't count on that. The other thing is sometimes these companies will pick their venue. For example, there's a case against Philip Morris is bringing a case against Australia over its cigarette labeling laws.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the U.S. and Australia don't have that provision in their trade agreement, but Australia had a deal, a treaty with Hong Kong that did have that provision. So Philip Morris is saying that it's really a Hong Kong company in order to sue the Australian government. And again, over a very sensible package, over plain packaging of cigarettes. So I think we could easily see in this country not only European firms deciding that some law is against their interests in suing, but even potentially U.S. firms going through a European subsidiary. So I think it really opens the floodgates to a lot of big problems, and there's really just no justification for having that kind of provision. It's, as I said, hugely controversial in Europe, both among citizens and governments. So far, the governments are saying they need to continue with this. And I think a lot of that is because they're hoping that this will become the sort of the gold standard, you know, that they can impose this then in the future in other agreements.
Well, you know, it basically makes it impossible. I mean, it entrenches existing industries, existing rules, existing power structures. You know, and as new science comes in, as new research is done, as new epidemiology is done, and we see the effects of some of these things, as new safety problems are revealed, you know, as happened with Fukushima, for example, you know, all of that, you can't adjust. There's no way to kind of go, okay, we knew that then, we think this now, or the population has shifted in its needs or views. You know, I mean, for example, after Fukushima, you know, the Japanese, I'm sure, you know, I know, hold different concerns about nuclear power than they did before the incident. So there's no opportunity for course correction in any of these key areas.
Right. And I think the other thing that's important to know is that this investor-state dispute settlement is not about getting compensation for direct expropriation. So it's not about the Swedish firm, Vattenfall, getting compensated for what they had invested in Germany. It's about indirect. It's about the profits they imagine they would have made, which I think is even crazier. And the standards, you know, it's not even about necessarily about a change in a law, but these very vague standards of fair and equitable treatment. So it really opens the doors to all kinds of challenges that you would never expect.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely, it sounds horrific. And why, it sounds backwards. Why should populations of different countries be accountable to corporations for their income?
Well, it's a really good question, and there has been pushback. There have been some countries that have dropped out. Bolivia dropped out a few years ago. I think the others are Ecuador, Nicaragua. There are a few others that are pulling out of these agreements, or as in the case of, you know, Australia, when we had a bilateral trade agreement with them, they refused to include investor state. So there are growing concerns about this. I mean, the other thing is, initially, I mean, the provision has been around for a while, since even before NAFTA, mm-hmm. but there were a few cases a year. Now there, it's just the number of cases are skyrocketing.
One of the things that Ralph Nader said, I was on a call with him, is that strategically, he believes, the companies have been slow to claim the use of this because they didn't want, you know, it to rise to a level where everybody was, you know, alarmed and worried about it, you know. But now it's being used more and more, and then this would open the door for, you know, a whole new magnitude of it. I mean, that's basically what he was projecting. Does that make sense to you?
It does. I mean, they are expensive cases to raise because they go on for several years. But the other thing we hear every once in a while is that there are cases, like a few years after it was put in place, there were reports that some states were considering some restrictions on cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And companies would go to them in a sort of blackmail effect and say, you know, if you do this, we will sue. And so there is evidence around the world, and you can imagine companies, if they're considering a lawsuit, you know, going to a state or a country and saying, you know, you'll pay for this if you try and implement these new rules.
It's hard enough. I mean, they're already speaking, you know, through lobbyists. They're already speaking to our elected officials through campaign contributions. They're already influencing them, and now, you know, and that's sort of the carrot, and now this gives them the stick. You know, the public doesn't stand a chance. I mean, democracy doesn't stand a chance in this kind of context. Let's shift gears from these investment dispute resolutions, and I'll just, you know, make one final point. You know, when we hear there's a court case, let's just talk about how the what kind of court case it is, because, you know, Americans will think, well, it'll go to the court and the judge will throw it out, and, you know, and if it's a bad ruling, we will appeal it, and this and that and the other, and, you know, this would be our assumption about the kind of court case it is. But that would not be accurate. What kind of court case, in fact, is it, and how is this tried?
This is really more like arbitration. There's a there'll be a panel picked from a roster of trade lawyers, basically, and so they'll pick, you know, one person for each side and then a judge, and the judge, the arbiter, will actually perhaps next time be one of the trade lawyers. So there's kind of an incentive there to be friendly, I think, to the whole process. Mm-hmm. So it isn't accountable in the same way our court system is. There's no, mm-hmm. you know, the only appeals would happen with that within that same body. Mm-hmm. So it is, you know, an entirely undemocratic mechanism. I mean, it's hard to see how they justify it internationally in any case, mm-hmm. both because of the undemocratic nature. I would also say, you know, in the case of Philip Morris, they're also suing the government of Uruguay over a similar deal. And so you have small countries spending millions of dollars in taxpayer money to defend these cases.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, no option on the other side for the governments to sue the companies. So it's very one-sided. It's undemocratic. They're not bound by normal legal rules of precedence, so the cases are a little bit unpredictable. It's, as I said, it's getting harder and harder to justify. In fact, there is a bill that's been introduced in Congress to get rid of investor-state dispute settlement. I don't know how far that'll really go, but it is becoming something that's being talked about more and more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it seems like, I mean, I think in terms of, you know, these treaties which, you know, have been, their contents and provisions have been kept secret, yet there have been many, you know, a lot of leaks, so we kind of know what they are. I mean, it seems that the two most obvious wrong things, without any special knowledge or understanding, you know, by anyone, would be, you know, the idea that the treaty itself is going to be fast-tracked without anyone being able to see it or change it, just kind of going, I trust you, you know, or you pressured me and I'm, you know, kind of kowtowing to you and therefore I'll vote for it kind of thing. You know, that's kind of very anti-democratic to begin with. And then these tribunals that would be set up to resolve these disputes and to, you know, kind of try these cases. I think those are the two most obvious things for the average person. But let's shift gears now and talk a little bit more about, you know, not the sort of the stick side, but you know how what the actual provisions, as they are known now to be within the Atlantic Treaty, you know what those are and what their impact will be on food and agriculture.
Okay. Well, first of all, most of what we know comes from Europe because a lot of meeting reports and textual proposals are being leaked from the European Union, more than I've seen with other agreements. And I think that reflects a lot of the unease people have about these agreements. But I think, you know, so on the European side, they generally have higher standards on food than we do. And when I've talked to people there, whether it's activists or government ministers, you know, I hear this constant refrain of they will not give in on GMOs, on hormone beef, on chlorine chicken. These are three huge issues. Now, these are also issues, if you look at Federal Register notices, so when the USTR put out a note asking for comments on TAFTA before it began, and they're still available on the web, and so you can see what different companies are asking for under this agreement. And so there's something like 300 letters up there, and of course, groups like ours posted letters as well about what a positive agreement might look like. But you can see very specifically, you know, what different companies are asking for, and you have different beef associations making a lot of noise about opening up European markets on hormone beef. You have things like the National Confectioners Association, which represents candy companies, insisting that they use the negotiations to weaken GMO labeling laws in Europe. Now, when we think about that, the thing is all of these kinds of provisions could boomerang back to the United States. If they make rules that affect labeling, say GMO labeling, it wouldn't only affect Europe, it would also affect the United States. So in states, you know, like Maine or Connecticut or Vermont, that have GMO labeling laws passed already, it could really put a damper on it. And I think in other states where there are campaigns underway to get GMO labeling, it would be one more thing that could make it that much harder.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's puzzling that the sugar manufacturers would be requesting this. I don't really understand why they would be. Do you?
I don't. It is a curious thing. I mean, and this is really only one of the ones we know about, you know, that they have said publicly that you can look up online. I think, you know, generally there, I would imagine that candy manufacturers are concerned about all kinds of labeling requirements. I don't actually know their motivation. What I do know is that there has been pressure. The U.S. has been putting pressure on Europe for years on different issues related to GMOs. Pushing them to open up both to importing GMO products and to allow planting of GMO seeds. This is a long-standing dispute. And, you know, in Europe, they rely on the precautionary principle, the notion that if there's any doubts, regulators, you know, if there's scientific uncertainty, regulators can be cautious and ban things until they find out. And I think with GMOs and GMO labeling, you know, it's both concerns about food safety and other concerns. People just want to know. You know, they feel they have a right to know what's in their food. And they may be concerned about other things, like environmental concerns related to GMO use and all of the pesticides that they generate, or corporate control related to GMO use. Well, Europe has mandatory labeling of GMOs in all food products, something we don't have. So that's something that's under attack. But I think what's important to understand from the trade agreements is they set certain standards about what's allowable and what's not. So we're already facing some trade suits over country of origin labeling of meat. And in the cases on the GMO labeling as well, they try to rope it off and say you can only label because of concerns about food safety when there is scientific certainty. Well, really, our right to know is broader than that. And the science isn't certain. The science is evolving. So the trade rules really restrict that kind of progress.
So, you know, I have a question. Do you feel that, I mean, apart from what the sugar manufacturer is asked, do you, is it actually known whether GMO labeling or food labeling in some other way is kind of on the chopping block, you know, with these agreements? Are we leaving it to the Europeans to, you know, push back and take it off the plate? Or, you know, what is the current status of that?
Well, it's a frustrating process. We don't actually know. I mean, I said there have been a lot of leaks, but, you know, there are leaks I get every few months. They're erratic. So we have partial information about what Europe is asking for. We have almost no information about what the U.S. is asking for in these agreements, because the U.S. is being much less transparent. So in cases like this, you know, we have to be proactive. We have to say, well, here's something we think it's worth being concerned about. We need to raise it loudly and publicly now. For example, when these negotiations started, a big concern we had was about farm-to-school programs. The EU wants to be able to bid on any kind of public procurement contract at any level in the United States. And this is really one of their major offensive goals in the trade negotiations. They want European firms to be able to bid on farm-to-school programs or transportation projects, different things that we think, you know, taxpayer money should be used to generate local employment, to support local values. But in the case of farm to school, we didn't actually know if they were, if that's what they were interested in. So it was something we had to push. So starting early in the talks, I started going to some of the stakeholder events. These are, you know, that the governments would convene when they had negotiating sessions. And at each one, I would lay out a series of concerns about GMO labeling, about farm-to-school programs, about food safety, and I'd look out at this, you know, group of negotiators, and I would always keep my intervention a little bit short, and I would say, "Tell me I'm wrong," and there would be this big silence. They just look at me like cats, you know. And so, but I kept raising that, and groups. Different organizations have been raising these issues, you know, in sign-on letters, in different forms of pressure. And so now I think probably Europeans have heard that. Probably it's not on the table. But we have, like I said, we have to be proactive. We have to think about what could be, what's not just invent things that are rational, things that are likely are being discussed, and push hard on those things. It would be much easier if we actually had access to the text. And I do want to say, you know, going back to history a little bit, in the early 2000s, the U.S. was tried to negotiate a trade agreement with most of the Americas, the free trade area of the Americas. And in that agreement, the governments published the negotiating text online, three different versions. They're still there on the web. And you can see precisely what was being negotiated. You can see the brackets where there were differences of opinion. So we could go to precisely what they were negotiating. And in this case, we don't have that kind of complete information. So we have to go with what we know and keep pushing.
Is there any, I mean, what is the rationale for making this secret, other than, you know, why does it have to be secret? I mean, why should anything that is going to, you know, affect our policies and our quality of life, our health, our environment, why, what is, you know, I guess back in the days when you were at war, you know, if you were negotiating the Paris peace talks, you know, between warring parties, you know, I could see a rationale for, we don't know whether we'll get this one to give in here or this one to give in there and what this sticking point might be. And so, you know, this is such a volatile situation that we can't really make the provisions as they evolve public, right, because we're dealing with two parties in conflict, you know. But this is a friendly agreement between different countries that's designed, you know, to hold hands and everything. It's not really about tariffs, as were treaties of yore. So what is the rationale for the secrecy?
It's a good question. It's something a lot of us are asking. I mean, they will say, you know, they need to negotiate behind closed doors so they can, you know, for similar issues on national security, but also because the talks are evolving. I think, you know, it's also true that in this case with the Free Trade Area of the Americas, those talks failed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they failed in part because they just couldn't survive the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
I also think, you know, there are other models out there, and I think this is part of it. We can't just accept that because it's always been done this way, that this is how it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
I've been looking at there's an organic equivalency arrangement between the U.S. and Europe, and I think mm-hmm. it's a really interesting case study because it was negotiated a few years ago. It went into effect in 2012. Organic organizations were involved in the negotiations. It was fairly transparent. Nobody thinks it's perfect, but everyone I've talked to, you know, people from the organic movement in the United States, the International Federation of Organic Movements, they all say it's a pretty good deal. And it's built in a way that every 5 years they review it, they make adjustments, they deal with issues they hadn't considered before. Mm-hmm. So you have this specific set of issues that needed to be dealt with. They dealt with it in a fairly transparent way and got a reasonable agreement. I think that's the kind of approach we should be going for. The problem is, if you had something like organics, for example, and you put it in the context of the trade agreement, well, who knows what they would be trading off? Maybe the organic rules would be traded off against something totally unrelated, you know, energy supplies or other kinds of food safety rules. And we just don't know when it's in that black box. I think, you know, the agreement with Europe really, there really isn't any reason they couldn't be doing a lot of this in a more transparent way and really pulling it apart to deal with the problems. Like on the organic trade, I think, I don't know if that was a problem so much. There were some opportunities, too. There are ways we can agree on different approaches.
Mm-hmm. Do you think organics or organic agriculture is at risk from these agreements?
It's hard to say. I mean, I've heard some rumors recently that they might be talking about organic within the trade agreement, organic standards. What I heard early on from someone involved in the talks was that they already had so many headaches to deal with. They felt like that one was done and they weren't going to mess with it. But I don't know if that's still the case. That's something we need to look into. But certainly what is at stake are different kinds of rules, I would say, particularly those that are emerging at the state and local level that try to change our food system.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big proposals in TAFTA, in the transatlantic deal, is for what they're calling regulatory coherence or regulatory cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a proposal to establish a process and a board so that if there was a new rule being considered on food safety, environmental protection, whatever, they would have to notify this council as much as a year in advance that they were considering it. Then do a cost-benefit analysis, and then the council would rule if it was the least trade-restrictive option possible. So, first of all, I don't even know how that would work, how you would notify something a year in advance. It doesn't seem practical to me. But in any case, the notion is that rather than leaving that kind of decision-making at the state level or at the federal level, wherever is most appropriate, you're putting this binational body in charge. You're creating some new roadblocks to getting new rules in process.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing we're looking at are the specific food safety rules that are being proposed in the trade deal. And it's a similar set of issues. You know, they say it needs to be the option that distorts trade the least, which isn't necessarily the option that's the best for public health or best for the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big push to say whatever is agreed at the federal level would apply at the state level as well. So, for example, one thing we raised in the last last round of negotiations is California has new laws on egg production that bans eggs produced in these small battery cages. Mm-hmm. Now, this is different than what's happening in other states. So, technically, under those kinds of provisions, that could be challenged because it's not consistent with other rules. In Minnesota, they're considering a ban on neonicotinoids. It's a chemical associated with bee colony collapse. Mm-hmm. That's something else that could be challenged under this trade deal. So there's this issue of local decision-making that I think is really important, and just the fact that this regulatory cooperation council would create just new roadblocks, making it even harder to make the changes in our food system that we need.
Well, you know, there are certain things. It's basically saying that global profit is more important than any local concern in any area that anyone could come up with. That, you know, that has no value, and that people lack that community-based self-determination. You know, one of the things that I hear a lot in the environmental movement is people saying, you know, go back to the country, plant your garden, this is the most radical thing you could possibly do. But, you know, if we don't have the, you know, if localities don't have the rights to self-determine around certain issues like the ones you describe, but have to conform to these policies, you know, that increase corporate profits for large companies, then, you know, that becomes a whole lot harder to do. And, you know, I think in a sense there is a truth to let's go back to the locality and all of that, but there's also, you know, a little bit of an escapist thing. It's simpler down here, back in the country. I can just plant my garden and the heck with whatever is going on, you know, on other levels or to other people. You know, if everyone just did that, we'd all be great. You know, that's been kind of a little bit of the environmental, you know, myth. And life would be simpler. We wouldn't need, you know, these big things. It's all going to collapse anyway, and we'll all have to go back there. You know, there's kind of a narrative along those lines that I've heard. Full disclosure, I reside, you know, in a major urban environment. And I've often said, well, what about the people here, you know? You know, lucky for you kind of thing. But in fact, not so lucky, given what you're describing.
Well, and if you think about, Even if we are, you know, focusing on, say, producing food locally, I think that is actually a good idea. And if you look at globally, you know, for the most part, the way people are fed is by food produced within a couple hundred miles of where they live.
Yeah, I'm all for that. I mean, I consume, you know, I would rather consume personally locally, minimally treated crops than, you know, spend the jet fuel importing, you know, organic salad from California. That's just my personal preference. But
even when it's a local crop, you know, mostly what we're talking about, especially in this country, is not someone who is, you know, is not subsistence farming. It's not someone who's growing everything they need just for their own family. There's been a huge growth in small farms in the United States, a lot of them people producing more sustainably. But those people need to be able to sell their crops, and they need to find ways to access new markets in ways that aren't necessarily, you know, controlled by big distribution centers, but give them options to make a profit selling sustainably. So this is a big reason we've been focusing on farm-to-school programs, both in the context of this trade agreement, but also my organization is looking to expand farm-to-school to things like farm-to-hospital or farm-to-daycare and finding new ways to get this healthier food into institutions in ways that build that market so that people can actually make a living doing this. And so, as I said, our big concern is that with these trade deals, you know, it's one more obstacle. If they say, You know, among when you put out a public bid, when a school system, say, or a hospital wants to buy food, and if you put in the bidding criteria that they get a preference if it's grown locally or if it's grown humanely in terms of animal production, under these kinds of trade rules, they could say, well, no, that's illegal. You can't consider that. And so then these small farmers are at a disadvantage, mm-hmm. and you start to break down, you know, this rebuilding of our food system at the local level.
What happened after NAFTA?
Well, certainly in NAFTA, you know, as I was saying, there was this process where farmers lost bargaining power, and you can see this huge shift. There's a Mary Hendrickson at the University of Missouri has been tracking the ratio of the biggest four companies in a given sector. So she's tracked, for example, in beef production. I'm trying to remember the numbers. Before NAFTA, it was something like 65% of production was controlled by just four companies. Now it's in the 80-some percent. And mm-hmm. you see a similar process in all kinds of different sectors of farm production. So you have fewer companies controlling more of production. So they're going to control what kinds of prices farmers get, what kind of prices they pay for inputs. Mm-hmm. So we've seen a huge drop in family farms in the United States. Now, as I said, there has been this growth recently mm-hmm. in these very small farms. But the ones that are a little bit bigger than that, family farms that are commercially viable, farms where really that is how people make their living, mm-hmm. those have really dropped. I'm forgetting the actual number, but it's something like it's dropped substantially by more than 100,000 farms since NAFTA began. And it is, you know, it's not only because of the trade agreement, because of the Farm Bill provisions and the way the system is rigged, but mm-hmm. The trade agreements certainly contribute to it, and they give, you know, it matters who has power in the distribution mm-hmm. system, and it has certainly diminished farmers' power.
Mm-hmm. What about, you know, I just was tweeted a question. Someone is asking, what about seeds? You know, what about control over seeds, seed saving, and, you know, all of those other things that farmers do? Is there anything in the agreements that, or, you know, on the patenting side or any other side that could affect our ability to have seed biodiversity?
You know, I don't know. I haven't followed that specifically in TAFTA, but certainly in the trade agreements, that has been a big issue. Mm-hmm. Seeds are considered, you know, that given the same kind of patent protection as other copyrighted materials, and so things like seed saving under many of the patent rules in many of these trade agreements are deemed illegal. When we negotiated CAFTA with Central America, that was one of the big points of controversy. Both, you know, also, I mean, this has been more well known on issues of essential medicines, where these trade rules on patent protections have made it very difficult for countries to make generic versions of medicines. But also with seeds, they required the Central American countries to all sign on to a particular treaty called mm-hmm. UPOV is the acronym, that gives plant breeders and seed companies more rights, more protections, something that the Central Americans had not agreed to before. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely built in to the approach on these patent protections in the trade agreements. And certainly others can speak more on the patent protections, but that has been hugely controversial over the years. And in fact, there was a big push years ago over drugs for HIV and AIDS. Because drug companies were able to control prices because of the patent protections and their desire to extend those protections internationally. There's been a lot of pushback. There was a really successful campaign. Mm-hmm. But it's something people do keep watching. So both for the drugs and for seeds, this is an issue.
Mm-hmm. What about, I mean, would it even go down to the level of, you know, someone trying to grow a home garden? I mean, is there a way that could then, in conformance with the treaties be, you know, somehow outlawed? I mean, would governments have to, for example, comply by, you know, preventing that because it's depriving, you know, a company of their future profits, or because it doesn't conform with, you know, the letter of the trade agreement in some way?
It's been an issue in developing countries, especially where seed mm-hmm. saving is a big way that farmers, you know, farmers produce. They cut their cost of production. They adapt the seeds to local conditions. And certainly that has been restricted by these patent rules internationally.
How has it been restricted?
Well, as I said, these patent rules give protection. So a seed company will have a copyright protection, essentially, a patent protection, a right, or under this UPOV agreement, a right to particular seeds, and no one can sell those seeds as their own. So if you have mm-hmm. farmers who are growing the seeds themselves, harvesting the seeds after they grow things, hanging on to the seeds and replanting, mm-hmm. that can mm-hmm. be deemed illegal under the trade deals.
Now, would it be illegal if they purchased those GMO seeds from Monsanto, or is it illegal for, you know, old heritage seeds that, you know, that have passed down in their family and they've grown forever? I mean, is it illegal, you know, or, like, why would all seeds come under, I mean, I can understand, you know, not that I, you know, I'm really in favor of it, but I can certainly understand, oh, we patented this particular seed. Are they going to try to patent everything on Earth and own everything? And therefore, you know, anyone who, you know, what about the heritage seeds and all the other seeds that people have that, you know, have been used traditionally? Are they all considered patented, or are they patenting them all, or what's going on with that?
Well, that's not an area I actually specialize in. I will say mm-hmm. that for the most part, those kinds of heritage seeds and all are not patented. So mm-hmm. they wouldn't be covered. So what's more of a concern are things like, yes, seeds, GMO or hybrid seeds sold by big companies like Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
But I could certainly put you in touch with people who could talk about that more on another show.
Yeah, that would be great, you know, because I am getting some questions about it from listeners. You know, let's touch back. We actually only have about 4 or 5 more minutes here to the program. Don't know if we can discuss this in that amount of time, but, you know, you can tell me. You had mentioned when we talked prior to the program that you had been involved in preparing a report of some kind, and you said that that was kind of an interesting, you know, stuff was revealed in the course of doing that. Is that something that, you know, you could kind of describe briefly
sure.
for our listeners?
There is a body in Maine, the Maine Citizen Trade Policy Commission, which was established, I don't know, a few years ago. It includes the state legislature, businesses, NGOs, mm-hmm. and they commissioned us to write a report of the potential impacts of TTIP on Maine agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really an interesting experience because we looked, you know, precisely at innovations they had in Maine, things, mm-hmm. you know, special rules that they had put in place to reshape mm-hmm. their food system, special mm-hmm. rules they had on dairy. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to make this very concrete. Mm-hmm. And then we had a public hearing, and actually I testified also to the Maine Agriculture Committee, but I think it raised a lot of really important debates, and it was nice to be able to really go down to look very specifically at how it was affecting folks in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're also reaching out to some other states that have similar bodies, but I think the fact that they have that body is really important because they can look at, you know, really specifically with what they are trying to do, and not only with their food system, but with other environmental rules as well, and consider what the trade impacts could be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. What would be, you know, what do you feel? I don't know if your organization does direct activism. I can kind of toss it out to listeners that if you're concerned about what we've been discussing on the program today and its impact on food and agriculture, as I am, you know, I'd recommend that you stay on top of these issues. You could take action by going to www. stopfasttrack.com, where by entering your zip code, you can easily be connected by telephone to your senators and congressional representatives and let them know that you'd like them to stop Fast Track, because by stopping Fast Track, we'll then be able to debate, discuss, and find out the real provisions of these trade agreements before we kind of give away the barn and decide to participate. You can also email them through going to stopfasttrack.com. I invite everyone listening to, if you've liked this program, pass it along to other people you know, educate them. Like us on iTunes. If you're just, this is the first or one of the first programs on this topic you're listening to, go to our Connect the Dot archives on PRN. In the last 2 months, there have been quite a few interesting programs on this topic, as well as over the last year, that you can listen to inform yourself. Also, warmly invited to go to my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health, where I regularly post upcoming radio announcements, as well as other actions, information, a lot of interesting curated content on all of the areas we've been discussing, and many, many more. You can stay informed that way. It's an easy thing. I curate a lot of interesting stories and content and sometimes some humor to help us, stay positive and keep moving through all of this and have a good effect. So that's a few things I can think of. Karen, do you have any cherished places that, you like people to go to stay informed or where they can follow the action on this as it progresses during this timely window over the next couple of weeks?
I agree that Fast Track is the priority right now. So definitely go to stopfasttrack.com. I would say people who want to learn more about these food issues can look on our website, mm-hmm. Which is iatp.org. We have partners in Europe called ARC 2020. If you go to arc2020.eu, you can see a lot about what folks in Europe are doing as well.
Great. And actually, there are a lot that folks in Europe are doing. I'm going to be doing some upcoming program with some of our European advocacy colleagues and everything like that, because the Europeans, are very involved and engaged and know that it's their right and their obligation to kind of make sure that we don't sign on to anything that's going to worsen our whole situation. In the minute or two that we have left before we sign off, Karen, and I just, want to thank you. This has been, Karen Hansen-Kuhn of IATP, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. It's just been terrific having you on as a guest. Are there food security issues? In other words, will we have food in the event of climate change? Will our food supply remain for us as it has been or, be under threat that are implicated by these trade agreements?
Certainly the trade agreements are about making things more uniform. And what we need for food security is more diversity, more biodiversity, more different kinds of experiences, more different kinds of planting. We are also, when we think about the alternatives, we promote something called agroecology, which brings together agricultural production and nature and farmers' knowledge. That's the kind of approach we should be pushing for. And the trade agreements, the way they're designed now, in many ways get in the way.
Thank you. Thank you. That's terrific. So your organization is really looking at those issues, and it's something we need to all think about. Thank you again, Karen Hansen-Kuhn, for being with me today on Connect the Dots. Thank you, listeners, for being with us, and we'll be back next week, Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, with another edition of Connect the Dots. Thanks very much.